So we're excited to be back. We're wrapping up a series today where we've been looking at the Song of Songs through an ecological lens. And so basically just asking, what does this book have to say to us about our shared home, right? About the earth, about our life on it. And so last week, Daniel gave a really lovely sermon on beauty and love and how those help us to better know God. And one of the questions that he posed was, is there a limit to the wisdom that we can glean from love? Right? Obviously, it's a rhetorical question. Like, no, there's no limit to the wisdom we can glean from love. And so we're just going to like marinate in love a little bit more today and go a bit deeper with it here. And I'm going to start us out by sharing about a book that I read earlier this summer that I found really moving. And I think it especially resonated with me because the author's story shares a little bit of overlap with my own. And it's a book, it's called Why I Am Not an Atheist. And I actually listened to it as well. So I was reading it and listening to it. Confessions of a Skeptical Believer by Christopher Beha. And it sounds like a kind of book that would be what we'd call like an apologetics, like a book that's meant to like defend the faith or maybe try and convince everybody that they should believe in a God. But I didn't read this book in that way. The author's married to a woman who is not a person of faith, and he seems perfectly at ease with that. It's not distressing. It just feels more like an autobiography where he's sharing his own story and like what's been helpful for him on his path. And so he's a philosopher and a writer by trade, and he had a series of tragedies in his teens and his early 20s that caused him to walk away from his Catholic faith. And so several people close to him died in succession. He was diagnosed with cancer at a really young age. He was convinced that he would die young. He did not, thankfully. But he delved into philosophy to try and help create some meaning in what he assumed was going to be a short life. And he considered himself one of the new atheists for a couple of decades, if that has any meaning for you, if you're familiar with that stream. And so a lot of this book is him just like weaving his own story in with some of the different philosophical theories that influenced him during these different phases of his life. And so if you don't enjoy philosophy, you're probably not going to enjoy this book. But for me, it was like there was this time in my life when I also read a lot of philosophy and I was searching for meaning and I was trying to wrestle with my own understanding of what I could possibly believe when I was kind of coming out of a childhood faith that wasn't working for me. And so I read a lot of Foucault, if you are familiar with Foucault. I want to say I read everything that he wrote, but I wouldn't swear to it 25 to 30 years later. I don't remember, but it was a lot. And then I read everything that the literary author Milan Kundera wrote. He was a fiction writer who was highly influenced by Heidegger and Sartre and Nietzsche, who I read a lot less of because he was a little chic at the time and everybody who was like trying to be, you know, cool was reading Nietzsche. And I feel like really self-conscious, like saying all of this stuff out loud, because it feels like a very like middle-class Western journey of like, oh yeah, I just had to read a bunch of philosophy to find myself, but I am what I am. And so reading all of these writers, where it led me to was actually a really high level of cynicism and depression. And I was in a lot of despair when I first moved up here to Ann Arbor, especially right after college. And I mean, I was just depressed out of my gourd. And I was in a bad place. And I resonated because that's where Christopher Beha said that his reading left him as well. Only he was like much better read than I was. He more educated in philosophy. He lived in that place a lot longer than I did. And he said he was hardly able to get out of bed. He developed a pretty bad drinking problem. And he got to a point where he said, you know, I think I just want to be alone for the rest of my life. And I don't want to be happy because it's not going to make me a good writer, right? So it's like really embracing that angsty artist thing. I did not go there, but that was where he was at. In his words, he said, I was secretly sure that I wouldn't live long. And leaving behind some significant work seemed like a far more urgent task than having a happy, functional life in the meantime. I wanted companionship. But I also wanted to dedicate myself entirely to the creation of my own meaning. And that a shared life with others might play some part in that creation hardly occurred to me. Happiness seemed like a shallow response to the realities of the human condition. But as often happens to us, you know, like when we're least expecting it, life kind of like sends us a fly ball. And suddenly we're looking up like, oh my gosh, I better pay attention to what's happening. And it kind of wakes us up. You know, his fly ball was that he met someone. And this was like in his mid-30s. And he said this time it was different. Instead of the usual mantra that he had with women he dated, which was keep the relationship short and don't have kids, he said that he met this woman at a party and he just kind of knew that this was a person that he didn't want to ever not have in his life. And so he tells some pretty funny stories about how unimpressive he was to her for the first few dates and how he knew he was going to kind of need to get himself in order if he wanted to have any kind of shot with her. There was kind of a funny story about for his first date. He was so nervous, and he's like, usually what I would do is I would drink a lot to calm my nerves, but I knew that I probably shouldn't drink a lot because that wouldn't be impressive to her, and the best thing for me probably would be to abstain, but if I abstain, that might be a red flag for her, and I didn't want to, you know, that maybe I have a problem with drinking, but I did have a problem with drinking, but I didn't want her to know I had a problem with drinking, and so, you know, he's all in his head, and so he's coming off in this completely, like, this way that was embarrassing for him, but it was motivating for him to make some changes in his life, and so he did, and he said his happiness increased. And for the first time in his life, he found himself wanting to stay with this person and then to get married and even to have kids who are now grown. And so his newfound joy was kind of just mind-boggling to him. And he realized that the worldviews that he had adopted in his 20s and early 30s just hadn't been working and that he had been miserable. He was just sort of like embracing this misery as a virtue. And it turned out that having love and joy was just a better way to live. And so that caused him to say, you know, maybe I need to kind of just push everything I think that I know about, you know, having a good philosophical foundation for living and just kind of push that aside, like clearing a table of clutter and not to like get rid of the clutter, but to just kind of start fresh and see what can be kept and what can be discarded. He said, so I told myself, suppose you start with love. That was the one clear and certain thing in my life. What would it mean to start there? To begin with the certain reality of that love and then build whatever could be built on top of it. And if I took that for true, what else would have to be true with it? So I'm going to do something I don't usually do, is I'm going to read a little longer section because he writes really beautifully about love here. So let's just listen to what he said. He said, starting with love means acknowledging the reality of other people, right? The people that we love, the people who love us, but also the people we fail to love and those whose love we lack but might one day earn. Truly loving someone requires taking their joys and suffering seriously on their own terms, recognizing their subjective world is every bit as rich and full as important as yours. Real love requires freedom, for it cannot be coerced. This freedom includes the freedom to reject love, to turn away from the good of the world. And at the same time, to love another person is to recognize them as a person. That is, something with an essential self, not just a collection of free choices. It requires that certain things endure, even as most things pass away. Everything I'd learned in my years of study told me this could not all be true. No one had yet explained how subjective mental selves could operate within an objective physical space. No one had yet reconciled individual freedom with a law-governed world. One way or another, you had to choose, but all I could say in response was that my starting point, my foundational principle, told me otherwise. And I read that, and a piece of me is like, well, yeah, it's love 101, right? You have to care about other people as much as you care about yourself, which is way easier said than done. Right? That's something that we're always learning how to do better through our lives. I was reflecting on it. What I heard in it was Martin Buber. So Martin Buber was a Jewish philosopher who wrote a book in the last century that I read a few years back. It's called I and Thou. So Ich und Du. Or in the German dialect I learned, Ich und Du. Right? It just means I and you. And if you know German, you know there's a difference between the kind of you that you use, right? So in English, the you I use for a stranger is the same as the you that I use for my wife. But in German, you use a different form of you for the people that you know really intimately, like your close friends and family. So this is I and you, the personal version. And Buber talked about how there's a lot of ways that we can relate to the world around us without relating personally to you. Like I can relate to an I, right? Two people centered on themselves and their own needs. And there's times when that can be appropriate, like if you're in like just a transactional relationship in business. But when you're trying to have a relationship with someone who's I relating to an I, that doesn't tend to generate love very well or happiness. I can relate to an it, to a thing. It can relate to an it. We can relate as a collective we, this sort of undefined, undifferentiated group, we and we, us and them, and so on. They said, but when we bring it home to I and you, as in this personalized, known you, that's when we can really talk about love. That love exists between I, who have agency and vulnerability and who can take accountability for my actions, and I have my own unique qualities and desires and needs. That love that exists between this I and you, I point at Rachel, poor thing, known you, who also has agency and can take accountability and is vulnerable and has her own needs and wants and desires. She says that's where the quality of our lives is shaped. And it's not that we can't love something bigger or that we can't love something abstract or that we can't love groups of people, but he says the real quality of our lives is shaped by the personal, right? That's where the magic happens. It's by the kinds of relationships that we cultivate in the concrete here and now with each other. In an I-it relationship, we experience people and objects and even nature as things to be used or analyzed or managed. Daniel touched on that just a touch last week, right? How we sometimes relate to nature only as a resource and that there are consequences for that. And this way of relating is sometimes necessary for parts of our everyday life, right? Science requires some sort of objectivity, practical tasks, parts of our work, but it can become dehumanizing to us if that's our only mode of engagement, if that's how we engage with everything in the world and with the people in our lives. But in an I-thou relationship, or I-you, we're meeting another person. Buber would even say an animal, or a tree, or a moment in nature. Even if it's fleeting, we're meeting them with openness and presence and mutuality and allowing ourselves to be moved and changed and impacted. And so for Buber, the I-thou relationship ultimately points to an eternal thou, this God who is encountered in the depth of authentic relationship, that God is the love that flows between I and you. Right? And so when we talk about a God who is a trinity of persons, it's this weird abstract thing, right? Christians are like, oh, God is three and, but three and one? So it's one God, but it's three, right? And so we're just trying to give language to the idea that we experience different aspects of God in different ways, right? There's God we experience as creator, God we experience as a guide, God we experience as the Logos, who we believe incarnated as Jesus, right? And so we're talking about, when we talk about an inherently relational God here, that's like relationship within the Godhead. And so we're talking about this love that's generated between God the Creator and God the Son, and God the Son, God the Spirit, God the Spirit, and God the Creator. And that love that's generated between them and within them, that is why we say God is love. That love is that fire between these aspects of the divine. It's the very essence of themselves and their existence. And we say this is mystical, it's unprovable, but this is the Christian imagination for what we're talking about when we say God is love and what the essence of love is. It's what's generated between the I's and the you's and healthy relationship to one another. And the gospel tells us, should we accept it, we have also been brought into that unity of love by God's grace, along with the entire creation, which we are charged with help bringing into that community of love. I was reading an entirely different book last week. It was a secular book on the ethics of technology. I get these little niche interests sometimes. And the author was talking about this blurring of the lines between technology and humans, right? And how humans are forming these sort of faux connections or false connections and friendships and even romantic attachments with things like AI and other tech. And her conclusion was is that we need to come back to an ethic based on this sort of I-thou relationship that Buber talked about. Because she said this like I-it relationship is damaging to us. If we're forming more and more connections with technology where we are sort of like the God, you know, there's like a power differential there. She's like, this is like tearing us apart and who we are as humans. She said, I-you attachment is love. It's embedded in vulnerability and the ability to hold power and authority without abusing this vulnerability. It represents a state of adulthood that is loving and kind and filled with wisdom and intelligence and fairness to others. In a state of adulthood, IU attachment can be a political force that transforms ethics, anthropology, and the economy. Right? Yeah, but this is like language coming from like a secular professor in England, right? Not a religious writer. And she and like Christopher Beha come to this conclusion that we have to start with an I thou love if we want to impact the world for the better and to live rich and fulfilled lives. Right? And they came to this conclusion that using love as the cornerstone for humanity is what's bearing the best fruit, to use churchy language. Right? And it turns out Christopher Beha here, our atheist, he concluded that the love that he sought as foundational might just be God. Like, oh, what if those stories I heard, like for him in confirmation class, what if those were true? What if God is love? What would that mean? And he says he knows he can never prove it, but this effect of him opening himself to that possibility and living as though that were true has been transformative for him. And so he said he just holds faith and doubt in tension, but that for him has been a better way to live. So then the question I have is like, what if there were a book that existed before these Western disciplines of philosophy and anthropology and ethics and so on came to be? A book that said essentially the same thing, but in a different way, because it's communicating through poetry. You know where I'm going with it. The Song of Songs. Right? What if it tells us that God is love, and that love is foundational for everything, and that relationships built on mutuality help us to know and love God and each other and ourselves and the world around us? Right? I mentioned, I think, in my first or second sermon, I don't remember, but that God or the divine, they're never explicitly named in the Song of Songs, and that's true. Right? There's an implied metaphor for God as one reading of the text, but there's nothing explicit. But I was doing a little extra reading after my first sermon, and I was reading a couple of Jewish scholars, and I realized there might be something a little bit more to say here. So I found this book that was like an Oxford University Press book, and there was this chapter that I was like, I've got to read this chapter. And I couldn't find it anywhere, and I couldn't even buy it, and I couldn't buy the article separately. I looked on and all the stuff. So I finally emailed the author, Dr. Daniel Grossberg. He's a retired professor. He was thrilled, I think, that somebody was looking for his work. And he was really sweet, and he like took like little JPEGs of his entire chapter and sent it to me and had some really good dialogue. It was lovely. And so I was reading his work and Robert Alter, who has since passed, but he's a great scholar, and they both noticed in the poem that some of the passages seem to hint that love takes on qualities that elsewhere are associated with God. So they said that throughout, hang on with me, I know we're a little bit late in the sermon here, but throughout the Song of Songs, there's like echoes of earlier biblical texts. Right? You know, like if some, like in a TV show, you're like, oh, I can see that they're, you know, they're referring to Romeo and Juliet or whatever. He's like, they're referring to texts that people would have known and said, oh, I recognize where that comes from. So we're going to revisit here the Song of Songs 8:6-7. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death, passion fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, a raging flame. Many waters cannot quench love, and neither can floods drown it. If one offered for love all the wealth of one's house, it would be utterly scorned. And so the opening lines of this portion echo Deuteronomy 11:18, which says, you shall put these words of mine in your heart and your soul, and you shall bind them as a sign on your hand and fix them as an emblem on your forehead. Right? Back in Deuteronomy, God's people are instructed to bind God's words in your heart and on your hand. And those words are, love the Lord your God and serve them with all your heart and with all of your soul. But they said, in the Song of Songs, the imagery is changed up a little bit. Instead of God's commandments being bound to the heart and to the body, it's the beloved. It's the lover themselves who is carried on the heart and on the arm, which suggests that the love becomes the defining, orienting force of life. That God and the law and God's worth are all interchangeable with love. And then that later portion, they said, echoes Isaiah 43:2. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through rivers, and they will not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. So Dr. Grossberg, who I was writing with, he said, the sharing of identical lexical choices is striking. Waters, rivers, drown, fire, and flame each appear in Isaiah as well as in the song chapter 8, but with a significant difference. He said, in the former, God's power over the waters and the rivers and the fire and the flame is prominent. And in the latter, it's the love that is impervious to these threats to death. Song 8, 6, and 7 suggests that love displaces not only Yahweh, but Mot, death, and the primordial personified waters of chaos that are subdued by Yahweh. And he gives other examples. They're more technical than we need to explore this morning. But I think what matters is the pattern that he identifies, which I think he's right. And that's that the poet seems to be deliberately evoking scriptures that would have been familiar to the song's earliest hearers and using language associated with God and then with God's power to speak about love, right? So it's like God and God's word and God's love start to converge here. And we might even conclude just from the Song of Songs that God is love. You know, like maybe John was shaped by this, right? And this love that's portrayed in the song, it's marked by mutuality, right? The lovers say, I am yours and you are mine. And one of the critiques of Buber's I and You is, you know, mostly because he was writing kind of before a lot of the postmodern writers, but they're like, you know, there can be like inherent power differentials that he's not taking into account. I actually think the Song of Songs is addressing this in its own way. Right? I mean, we even might even think about like God's love for humanity. Well, God is God. Like, how can we have a mutual relationship? But I think this is what Paul was getting at in Philippians when he talks about how Jesus emptied himself and became a human, the lowest of the low humans. It was to show us that his heart toward us is to have a relationship of mutuality, that he was willingly laying down his power so that he can be in this relationship of love with us. And that's the kind of humility that he was showing to humanity. And you might see this in the Song of Songs because it's mostly the woman's voice in here, and the man it's presumed to be some sort of probably royalty of some sort. And you might think, well, gosh, in that day and age, it was probably a fairly big power differential. But isn't it interesting that the poem's central voice really challenges these patriarchal assumptions that we might be like surprised by from a work this ancient? Right, it's like subverting that dynamic. This is a woman speaking who is free to choose, free to pursue her lover, to consent to the relationship, and to speak really openly about her desire. And so I think the song here is telling us something really important about the nature of love, and also then the nature of God. And that's that love requires freedom. And love grows through mutuality and through reciprocity. And each person encounters the other as a true thou, a true you, a person with desires and needs and freedom and life that's as rich and as meaningful as one's own, and that's true regardless of gender, which makes the song really provocative for its time. As I close up here, I want to read you 1 Corinthians 13 and see what we're hearing here from Paul. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but I do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and I can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but I do not have love, I'm nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and I give over my body to hardship that I might boast, but I don't have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it does not dishonor others, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs. That one's hard. Love does not delight in evil, but it rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. Right? Do we hear the Song of Songs in this? Many waters cannot quench love. There is nothing that can keep it down. This is the strongest form in the universe. This is the strongest power. And it's the reason that people like Christopher Beha and that Kathleen Richardson and these scholars are coming to this conclusion of like, oh my gosh, we have to start with love. And it sounds abstract, but you know what? We can break it down. You know what it is? It's patient and kind, and it doesn't envy, and it doesn't boast, and it's what takes place between you and I. And when we're in a place where we're doing some healthy healing of our I-thou relationships, we're growing in love and we're growing in our understanding of God. Does that make sense? I would say that's what we can learn about our shared world here this morning from the Song of Songs. God is love. Love takes shape in relationships that are filled with freedom and mutuality. It's the strongest force we can imagine, and it is worthy of becoming the foundation upon which everything else is built. Amen. All right, we often have a little time here of guided meditation or silence. I thought I would just offer, if you would like, in this time when we're spending just some quiet time together, if it's helpful to you to like picture somebody that you know, that you really care about, where there's maybe been a little disruption in that I-thou relationship. And maybe we can just picture them before God and just remember that they too carry hopes and fears and joys and burdens the same that we do, and just hold them before God's light. All right, so we'll just offer that if that's helpful to you, and I'll let you know when the time is up here. Lord, we ask that you would help us to see people with their full humanity. And we ask also that you would help us to understand that you see us in our full humanity. And that just as we are loved. Doesn't mean we don't have some transforming to do, doesn't mean we don't have rough edges, but no matter where we're at, no matter what our rough edges, the starting point is love, and you love us just as we are. And I ask that that truth can just sink down deep into us and that we can carry that forth and that we can love others in the same way that we are loved by you. Amen.